Good morning, and you are very welcome on this day after Valentine's Day. So all the chocolates are on sale today. So we are continuing our study of read through of 2 Chronicles, and we are looking in chapters 8 and 9, and this is the last message from 2 Chronicles concerning King Solomon. We'll be looking at two chapters today, and what is presented to us from the chronicler is not your usual sermon topic. We have Solomon's accomplishments, and they are divided into four main topics: Solomon's power, his worship, his riches, and his wisdom, which includes the famous visit from the Queen of Sheba. And then the last few verses will be his death and burial. So those will be the four points that we will discuss this morning. But before we read, I think it is important that we remind ourselves who the audience was for the Chronicles and why the chronicler emphasized things in his writing as compared to the similar stories in 1st, 2nd Samuel and 1st, 2nd Kings. The chronicler used the scrolls of Samuel and Kings and other sources as he wrote this account for the Jews who had been in exile in Babylon for 70 years. They were allowed to leave and go to Jerusalem to rebuild the city, the walls, and the temple. So everything that we're reading is already history for them, for the audience. And they've been in exile for 70 years. Idolatry had been Israel's downfall. And it was the reason that God gave up on them and allowed them to be conquered by King Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon. This was not something that should have surprised them, because God had warned them about this, that this would happen if they turned from him and worshiped other gods. And you can read about those warnings in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. They were warned about 1,000 years before it happened, and you can't say that they didn't know, because they were everything. History was an oral tradition. They carried things down through the centuries, and they knew what the Bible. They knew what God's law was. So they knew. So they can't say that they didn't know. Yet for the chronicler, his whole premise in writing was to warn and encourage. His warnings were concerning the past failures of Israel and their monarchy, and the encouragement was of God's forgiveness and restoration. Israel knew why they were 70 years in Babylon. They knew all about the bad decisions of the kings of Israel. The chronicler makes his case that the two greatest earthly kings were David and Solomon. They were the standard that was set for all other earthly kings, yet there was a king with a capital K yet to come to sit forever on the throne of David. That was and is Jesus. So as we read through these two chapters, think about God's goodness to Solomon and to his people. The glory that Solomon had was all from the Lord. It was all due to God's blessing of Solomon and the people, and it gives us a glimpse of an infinitely greater place, the glory of heaven. But we'll also look at the very end on what does all of this mean for us. So with all that said, let's read through the text. It's, like I said, it's two chapters. I'm going to read through it. I'll make three or four stops along the way just to comment on what we just read, but we'll continue on through the two chapters. Then we'll go back and we'll talk about four different things, but I'm going to lump two of them together, so it's going to be kind of three small points, and then the application. What does this all mean for us? So here we go. 2 Chronicles, chapters 8 and 9. At the end of 20 years, in which Solomon had built the house of the Lord and his own house, Solomon built the cities that Hiram had given to him and settled the people of Israel in them. Okay, so just going to stop there. Don't worry, I'm not going to stop every two verses. But these are cities that Solomon had given to Hiram, and that's somebody, you just need to read the previous chapters to know who Hiram is. They had given to Hiram as a thank you for providing all the building materials and labor that the king of Tyre had given him for the temple. Hiram gave these cities back. So instead of being upset with Hiram for returning gifts, Solomon rebuilt the cities, and he fortified them, and he populated them with people of Israel. In the next few verses, detail how Solomon rebuilt and fortified many more cities. And several of these extended to the edges of the land, so he garrisoned with military to protect the land. And the one city, Tadmor, was an important city. It was near an oasis on the spice route. It became one of the richest cities in Israel. Okay, I'll continue. And Solomon went to Hamath of Zobah and took it. And he built Tadmor in the wilderness, and all the store cities that he built in Hamath. He also built up Upper Beth Horon and Lower Beth Horon, fortified cities with walls and gates and bars, and Baalath, and all the store cities that Solomon had, and all the cities for his chariots, and the cities for his horsemen, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. All the people were left of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. All of those people were not of Israel. From their descendants, who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel had not destroyed, these Solomon drafted as forced labor, and so they are to this day. To this day, meaning the day that the chronicler wrote this. But of the people of Israel, Solomon made no slaves for his work. They were soldiers and his officers, the commanders of his chariots and his horsemen. And these were the chief officers of King Solomon, 250, who exercised authority over the people. Even though the reign of Solomon was mostly a time of peace, as he fortified cities and he moved population into those cities, he was also going to defend those cities. Just only logical. These cities were not just for military presence, but they were also cities where grain and food were stored. Verse 11 is an interesting verse. Solomon brought Pharaoh's daughter up from the city of David to the house that he had built for her. For he said, "My wife shall not live in the house of David, king of Israel, for the places to which the ark of the Lord has come are holy." So the chronicler does not go into detail about Solomon's many wives and concubines, most of which were for military and peace treaties. His audience would already know all this. But the one wife he does mention is the daughter of the Egyptian pharaoh, connecting this story back to the Exodus, when God led them out of bondage, out of Egypt. And it also leads into the next few verses about worship. So she was probably still pagan, we don't know. So the chronicler was showing how Solomon was honoring his wife and honoring God. So he built another house for her away from the Ark of the Covenant. Verse 12, then Solomon offered up burnt offerings to the Lord on the altar of the Lord that he had built before the vestibule, as the duty of each day required, offering according to the commandment of Moses for the Sabbaths, the new moons, and the three annual feasts, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. According to the ruling of David his father, he appointed the divisions of the priests for their service, and the Levites for their offices of praise and ministry before the priests, as the duty of each day required, and the gatekeepers in their divisions at each gate, for so David, the man of God, had commanded them. And he did not turn aside from what the king had commanded the priests and Levites concerning any matter and concerning the treasuries. Thus was accomplished all the work of Solomon from the day the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid until it was finished. So the house of the Lord was completed. So worship was very important to Solomon. We'll talk about that in a few moments. The chronicler made sure the people understood that if keeping God's commandments was important to the two greatest earthly kings, it should be important to them as well. Then Solomon went to Ezion-Geber and Eloth on the shore of the sea in the land of Edom, and Hiram went to him by the hand of his servants, ships and servants familiar with the sea, and they went to Ophir together with the servants of Solomon and brought from there 450 talents of gold and brought it to King Solomon. Israel was never a seafaring people, so the collaboration with Hiram, king of Tyre, is not unexpected. Gold from Ophir was known for its high quality, and this partnership brought more riches to Israel. Chapter 9. Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon, she came to Jerusalem to test him with hard questions. Having a very great retinue and camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones, and when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from Solomon that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, and their clothing, and his cupbearers, and their clothing, and his burnt offerings that he had offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom, but I did not believe the reports until I came, and my own eyes have seen it, and behold, half the greatness of your wisdom was not told me. You surpass the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are these your servants, who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on his throne as king for the Lord your God, because your God loved Israel and would establish them forever. He has made you king over them, that you may execute justice and righteousness." And she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. There was no spices such as those that the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the servants of Hiram and the servants of Solomon, who brought gold from Ophir, brought algum wood and precious stones. And the king made from the algum wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, lyres also, and harps for the singers. There never was seen the like of them before in the land of Judah. And King Solomon gave to the queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked, besides what she had brought to the king. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. The queen had heard of Solomon, his wisdom and riches, but when she visited him, questioned him, and saw the opulence of Jerusalem, she found the experience literally breathtaking. Now, to the finish here of chapter 9. Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, besides that which the explorers and merchants brought. And all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the land brought gold and silver to Solomon. King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of beaten gold went into each shield. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold, 300 shekels of gold into each of those shields, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. The king also made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps and a footstool of gold, which were attached to the throne. On each side of the seat were armrests and two lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, one on each end of a step on the six steps. Nothing like it was ever made for any kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the Feast of Lebanon were of pure gold. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon, for the king's ships went to Tarshish with the servants of Hiram, and once every 3 years the ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom, and all the kings of the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and of gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, mules, and so much year by year. And Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots, 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. And he ruled over all the kings from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and he made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And horses were imported for Solomon from Egypt and from all lands. Now the rest of the acts of Solomon, from first to last, are they not written in the history of Nathan the prophet, and in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer concerning Jeroboam the son of Nebat? Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel 40 years, and Solomon slept with his father and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam his son reigned in his place. Even trying to imagine Solomon's wealth and the wealth of Israel at that time is nearly impossible. There was so much gold that every day utensils were made of gold. He made decorative shields with the excess gold, not just one or two, but hundreds. And silver was as common as stone and worthless. So let's now look a little closer at what the chronicler wanted Israel to know, and what we learn from these chapters. Well, first, Solomon's power and wealth. I mean, when you read the Bible and you read it to apply to yourself, then you need to find where you are in the text, meaning if you're reading one of the Gospels, are you one of the disciples? Are you Jesus? Are you one of the crowds? Well, I'll just help you right here. None of us are Jesus. But we can't identify with one of the disciples, like Peter. His eagerness to get out of the boat, to go to Jesus, and then his fear when he sees the storm around him and he takes his eye off Jesus. We can identify with somebody like Peter. So as we read these chapters, who can we identify with? See, the chronicler was writing to an audience who were basically in the opposite situation than Solomon. I mean, Solomon was and would still be the richest person in the world. You take what he had then and put it in today's money, and he is two or three times more than the four or five wealthiest people in the world put together. His worth is somewhere between 2 and 4 trillion euros of today's standard. So we can't relate to Solomon. And the people, the original audience to the Chronicles, couldn't relate to Solomon. Solomon had the power, the riches, and the fame. The people are coming out of exile. They had nothing. No power, no fame, no glory. In essence, they were very much like the people of Israel during Solomon's time, meaning Solomon was blessed by God, he was appointed king by God, and he was to lead and rule God's people. The people who were in exile were to see themselves as the king's subject. But they didn't have a king. Their king was God. That's the whole point. They are beneficiaries of the king, with a big K. Not Solomon, because Solomon is long gone by the time that they're reading this. Israel were beneficiaries of Solomon's reign as king. In Israel back in the day, in that history, Israel coming out of exile were beneficiaries of God's power. It is through him that they are able to start their lives again, that they are to trust in God. Look at the opulence of the throne in chapter 9. It was massive, made of gold and ivory, with a dozen golden lions, two on each side. I mean, a little bit much. Who sat on the throne then? Solomon. But whose throne was it? Well, ultimately, it's the Lord's. It was to be a vision, a glimpse of the heavenly throne. The Bible commentator Michael Wilcox said, "Greatness belongs to the one who sits on the throne. His people are needy, but his greatness meets their needs." Solomon met their needs because God blessed Solomon. And truly, it was God who met the needs of Israel. And it would be God who met the needs of these exiles as they returned to Jerusalem. They don't see a throne. I mean, that throne that's described here is gone. But the heavenly throne is there forever. And yes, David and Solomon occupied the throne for a time. They were not perfect. And after them, there were 20 more who would occupy the throne until the throne was taken away. When the exiles go back, there will not be a monarchy. But it is God who is leading them from the heavenly throne. God will use men as leaders of Israel again, yes, but they won't be kings. They'll be people like Nehemiah, one of the books of the Old Testament, Zerubbabel, and others. But the issue is not who is on the earthly throne, but who is leading them. When God's people are being led by a godly leader, then God will bless them. This can be their experience as they go back to Jerusalem, as they look ahead to a future and greater leader, which would be Jesus. They knew the scriptures. Genesis 49:10 says, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him and the obedience of the people is his." That's a prophecy of Jesus. And again in Isaiah 9:6, "For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." There are many more prophecies of Jesus in the Old Testament that these people would have known. And so that's what the chronicler is reminding them of, who ultimately they should be looking for. Then there's Solomon's worship. Who could imitate Solomon in anything he did? Everything was grander than what anyone had ever done or could imagine. So to think that the audience of the chronicler was to try and imitate Solomon's temple should not be expected. They have nothing. No money, no building materials, no skilled workers, nothing left over from Daddy, meaning from King David. Everything had been pillaged or destroyed by the Babylonians. But it's easy to go that route, to look at other churches or other ministries and be jealous of what they have. We are good at comparing what we have with what other people have. Last summer, when we were traveling all over the U.S., visiting about 20 different churches during that time, we saw a lot of nice buildings with a lot of rooms. Big choirs, big orchestras, big concert piano, big organ, big stage, big sound system, big video system, big everything. Churches that size, I was looking at them, and I wished we had congregations in Ireland that would require a building that size. I wish we had enough people interested in the Bible and desiring a relationship with Jesus so that we could have a church that size. And then we are in a small country church, similar in size to Grace Baptist. They had about 30 or 40 people. They have a nice old building with a fellowship hall that had been built onto the church with a kitchen. That was the size of a building I wish we had. Yes, I was kind of guilty of being, a bit jealous. So it's easy for us to look at what's there and what we don't have. But despite all that gold and all the big ornate trappings of Solomon's palace, the chronicler wanted those coming out of exile to see how proper, genuine worship was important to David and to Solomon. It wasn't the building, it wasn't the grandeur of the building or the ornateness of the decorations. It was keeping the rules of worship that God had set for them. It was keeping the sacrifices and the feasts at the proper time. It was a matter of the heart, being diligent and genuine in worship. Because God doesn't care about tradition. He doesn't care about what the building looks like. I mean, we looked at earlier, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Solomon said he can't build something grand enough for God. Who can? But God is so much greater than anything. It's what you're doing in the building that matters. God doesn't care about all the pageantry. He cares about what's in your heart. Keeping God's commandments was important to David, to Solomon, and to Israel, and so it should remain important for God's people as they return to Jerusalem. And there's Solomon's wisdom. Part of God's blessing of Solomon with wisdom and knowledge was not only to lead God's people, but to share God's wisdom with the nations. It wasn't just for Israel. It was to bless all people. Solomon was able to bless the nations with God's wisdom and the knowledge of God. Who would be like modern day minds that people would want to learn from? Well, in the last 150 years, probably Einstein or Tesla would come to mind. I was able to hear one of the great theological minds of the 20th century, Francis Schaeffer. He visited a nearby Bible college in Indiana when I was in school, and I went to hear him and his wife Edith and their son Frankie speak. Francis was a deep thinker, and to be honest, I didn't comprehend much of what he talked about. I just remember sitting there wishing I could. He was on a much higher level. Yet he would be astounded by Solomon's wisdom. You know, the visit to the Queen of Sheba is one of the most recognized events in the Bible, though it only spans just a few verses. Was she amazed? Yes. Did she put forth many questions to him? Yes. Was there anything that Solomon could not answer? No. She was amazed, and the experience was literally breathtaking. She had heard stories of Solomon, yet those stories didn't compare to the reality of seeing the wealth of his kingdom, the happiness of his people, and hearing the wisdom and knowledge that he possessed. But the queen said something that the chronicler wanted Israel to know. Look again at what she said of Solomon and God. The key to these two chapters is in these two verses, chapter 9, verses 8 and 9. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on his throne as king for the Lord your God. Because your God loved Israel and would establish them forever, he has made you king over them, that you may execute justice and righteousness. All the glory goes to God. She could easily be impressed by the gold and the ivory and the peacocks and the apes, being surrounded by gold, drinking from gold mugs, eating with gold utensils off gold plates. Everything was gold. She could have been impressed, yet she gave all the glory to God. It was God who blessed Solomon. It was God who gave Solomon the power, the riches, the wisdom, and the knowledge. It was God who placed Solomon on God's throne. It was God who allowed him to govern God's people because of God's love for them. It was God every step of the way. And that's the central encouragement to these people who have been in exile for 70 years. God will be faithful to you. God will lead you. God will care for you. God blessed David and Solomon so that he could bless Israel through their leadership. And even though those kings are gone now, God will bless you just the same. And through Israel, the nations will be blessed. There's a new song that I've enjoyed recently called Goodness of God. And it talks about the faithfulness of God. And he knows we as believers are still prone to sin and failure, yet he keeps coming after us. He is faithful and good. And I see that in David and Solomon's life. Yes, they are messed up. And yes, the goodness of God sustains them. And that was the encouragement for the exiles. That God is faithful. Jesus said in Matthew 6, 28 and 29, "Observe how the wildflowers of the field grow. They don't labor or spin thread, yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all his splendor was adorned like one of these." So who are we in the story of the queen's visit with Solomon? We are the exiles in Babylon. We are the wildflowers out in the field. What God has planned for us in heaven is far greater than anything that Solomon built. Solomon's temple may have been a vision of heaven on earth, but heaven will be infinitely greater than what Solomon had. One theologian said, "If the glory of lilies that God causes to grow in the countryside exceeds the regal wonder of Solomon's clothing attire, can you imagine how magnificently the place that he is preparing for us will surpass any accomplishment we have ever known? The best is yet to come." Well, what does this mean for us? There's two things I want to look at, just to focus on. How worship was important to Solomon, and the influence that they had on the king and of Sheba, that she was seeking God. First, let's think about worship. What was important to Solomon? It was keeping the law, making sure the sacrifices were done as the Lord commanded and the feasts were kept. Worshiping God was not to be routine. It wasn't just to tick the box for the week and then go on your merry way. No, worship of the Lord was to be a part of life. Life is not life if there is no God. There's an old bumper sticker that says, "No God, no peace." No God and no peace. And I would say the same would be true to say, "No God, there's no life." No God, no life, eternal life. How important is worship to you? Worshiping Jesus is not just Sunday morning. It's every day. When you read the Bible, when you pray, when you help someone, when you listen to a YouTube video of a Christian song, or listen to a good sermon, someone who preaches the Bible. Worship must become a way of life. It's not just an afterthought. Are you reading the Bible every day? I mean, that was my challenge for everyone at the beginning of the year. At least 15 minutes a day of reading the Bible. Download a Bible reading plan. Ask me. Use the plan in the little daily bread booklets. After you read, pray about what you read. Ask God to show you how that applies to your life. I use a journal for prayer. I write out my prayers. And anything else you can do, and another thing that you can do is to copy the Bible. Get a blank copy book. Use your favorite translation. I use the English Standard Version, the ESV. Turn to your favorite book of the Bible and just start writing the Bible, copying word for word. I've been doing this for a few months now. It slows me down and helps me see God's Word even better because I'm reading it and I'm writing it. And it's important to worship together, coming to Sunday morning services and Wednesday Bible study as often as you're able. It is encouraging to worship with other believers, to pray with other believers, and to study the Bible together. The other important thing is, from these chapters to remember, is how the queen was seeking answers. Where was Sheba? I mean, there are two main schools of thoughts. Sheba's either ancient Ethiopia or ancient Yemen. Both are south of Jerusalem. The Ethiopian historians believed very strongly that the Queen and Solomon had a marriage of convenience, as he did with many countries, and that he was the father of one of her sons. That is also very possible, yet none of that really has anything to do with us, so why am I saying this? Well, the Queen learned of God from Solomon. Nothing was held back. She asked questions about anything and everything, and Solomon had the answers. And most assuredly, some of her questions were about the God of Israel. If Sheba was in Ethiopia, then there were God-fearing Gentiles in Ethiopia. The Ethiopian church connects its roots back to the queen after she visited Solomon. So why is this important to us? In the New Testament, in Acts chapter 8, there is a eunuch from Ethiopia, a servant and high-ranking official of the queen of that time, which is centuries after the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon. And this eunuch, his high-ranking official, who answered only to the queen, he was sitting in a chair reading in a chariot reading the scroll of Isaiah. God sent Philip, one of the original seven deacons, to talk with this man. This man was high-ranking, answering only to the queen. He was sitting in a chariot, which showed his wealth and his status, and he had a scroll of Isaiah, which really was a priceless item, since it was handwritten on vellum. And he was searching, and he was asking for help. When Philip approached him, he asked if he understood what he was reading, and the man said, "How can I, unless someone guides me?" Philip joined him in the chariot and noticed that he was reading from Isaiah 53, chapter 53, which is a prophecy about Jesus, about how he would be sacrificed as a lamb for the sins of man. The eunuch also asked Philip who was the prophet talking about, and Philip opened his mouth, and beginning with this scripture, he told him the good news about Jesus. The eunuch believed and wanted to be baptized right then. The Queen of Sheba was a Gentile, meaning not a Jew, and she was searching for truth and wisdom. And she took the truth of the Lord back to her country, and that started the God-fearing community in Ethiopia. The eunuch was from the same country in Acts that I just mentioned, and a God-fearing man, yet he had not heard about Jesus, and he was searching for truth. And then he was asking about Jesus, desiring to be baptized. We are Gentiles, grafted in to the church, as Paul says in his letters in the New Testament, and we have access to salvation through Jesus Christ, just as the eunuch. The gospel was spread so that the nations would be blessed, and we are part of that blessing. We can believe on the Lord Jesus and be saved. Because without Christ in our life, how can we reconcile our relationship with other men, with other people? Our relationship with Jesus is foremost before anything else. Before we can reconcile our relationships with other men, we have to reconcile our relationship with Jesus. We cannot love other people without the love of God. So where are you this morning? Do you know Jesus? Do you want to know Jesus? Do you want to be baptized? Are you searching for answers? Are you searching like the queen, like the eunuch? Turn to Jesus. He can supply all your needs. As much wisdom as Solomon had, Jesus is infinitely more because he's God. Turn to Jesus and be saved and know the goodness of God.